Revelation chapter 6 this evening, please. Revelation chapter 6. And before we read the verses, let's just go ahead and pray this evening, and we'll kind of walk our way through the verses as we come to each of the seals. Heavenly Father, I pray again for your help that I would have good understanding of your word and that would teach it faithfully and accurately, that you would help us to understand and to receive it as it is, the Word of God, not fiction, not fable, and pray these blessings in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, of course, tonight with chapter number 6, we begin not only the lengthiest section in the book of Revelation, and here's what I mean by that, right? The book is the revelation of Jesus Christ. We have seen him as the chief shepherd of his churches, chapters 2 and 3. And we have seen him as the crucified and worthy lamb, chapters 4 and 5. Now we see him as the God who is sending his wrath upon the earth. That's chapter 6 through almost the end of the book. So not only the longest section, but realistically, depending upon your point of view, either the most exciting portion of the book or the most confusing portion in the book. Before we get into the verses specifically, I want to take just a moment, and I don't really want to bogged down in all of this in minutia and academia, but there are two major trains of thought with reference to the way the book now unfolds. And of course, in any time there's a disagreement, there's a lot of discussion about it, and there's a lot of arguing why one position is right and a different position is wrong. And I really don't want to spend, as I've already said, a lot of time on that. God's judgment upon the earth in the book of Revelation primarily comes to us through three media, right? We have the seals, which give way to the trumpets, which give way, if you have a King James Bible, it will say vial and maybe a note with bowl. If you have a different version of the Bible, it might just say bowl. And there are seven of each. So there are 21 distinct events concerning the seal and the trumpet and the vials. And in those are unpacked all of God's judgments upon the earth. So the seals take us through chapter 7. The trumpets begin in chapter 8 and take us through about the middle of chapter 11. The vials begin in chapter 15 and take us through chapter 16. And we'll talk about how that all fits together. So here's where I'm going. All right. One major way we could look at these, the seals and the trumpets and the bowls, is to view them as being parallel in nature. Technically, this would be known as the recapitulation view. And if you Googled the recapitulation view of Revelation, you would be exposed to all kinds of information about it. And here's the point that I'm making. If we took a recapitulation approach to this, we would make the case that the seventh seal and the seventh trumpet and the seventh vial are all describing the same exact event. A little bit different perspective, but they're all describing the same exact event. And there are some similarities between them, which is one of the reasons that people argue for them. So we could go, right, when you got one, right? So that would mean that we're going to correlate the first seal to the first trumpet, to the first vial, and they're not talking about different things. They are talking about the same thing. The other major way of thinking about these things is to view them as occurring in succession. Not parallel, but in succession. Which again, technically, if you wanted to Google it, you would be looking at the telescoping or the dovetailing approach to the interpretation. And under that view, for instance, the seventh seal and the seventh trumpet and the seventh vial are different events, not describing the same event. This is pretty much the approach that I'm going to take, the telescoping or the consecutive or the dovetailing. But certainly there are, in the course of the book, explanations about different things, kind of a little bit of a pause while something larger is explained. For instance, it's very difficult to put Revelation chapter 12 and to scrunch it strictly into the chronology of Revelation when it is a description of Satan's ongoing war against the people of God. But for me, primarily, the primary argument is just simply this, folks, is that these things are really presented to us consecutively. Right? The very fact that they're given to us in numerical value argues for their succession. Numbers describe sequence. Two comes after one. Three comes after two. This is one of the ways we use numbers and one of the ways that numbers are helpful to us. So, again, that will be the approach that we take. And we would argue, and I would agree with this, you know, those in arguing for the sequential view, is that to view the items in parallel fails to account for the great increase in intensity that we see as we progress through from the seals to the trumpets to the vials. There is an ever-increasing intensity to these judgments. So again, just to kind of summarize how I'm approaching it, this would be my understanding. There's, of course, differences of opinion, and, you know, so not in any way, trying to be dismissive of other good people, but with reference to the events beginning in chapter 6, right, I would view them as being futuristic. They have yet to happen. They have not happened in history. I would view them sequentially. First we have the seals, then the events of the trumpet, then the events of the vials. I think that when we get to Revelation chapter 11, we are describing events that are clearly at the middle. Although I also think by the time we get to the sixth seal, we are close to the middle of the tribulation. And that all that we are about to read falls under the heading of what the Bible calls the day of the Lord, the day of God's judgment upon the earth. So Revelation chapter 6 explains to us the first six seals, and tonight we're going to just look at the first four. And then we will deal with the fifth separately, and we will deal with the sixth separately. So we'll spend 3 weeks in chapter number 6. All right, so let's just turn our attention then to chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. And again, right, not only are we looking at them in numerical sequence, we want to look and just make sure that we're attentive to what is exactly happening here. In chapter 4 and 5, right, we have had John ushered into the presence of the Father, who is sitting upon this magnificent throne, attended by adoring and worshiping multitudes. And then we are introduced to the Lamb at his right hand, who is worthy to unleash the judgments that are contained in the book. And it is the Lamb, it is the crucified Christ, who then becomes the one who is identified with these judgments, right? This is a Jesus that many people do not believe exists. But notice verse number one, I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals. I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals. Some people think, and let's just go ahead and read verses 1 and 2. I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard as it were the noise of thunder, one of the four beasts saying, come and see. And I saw, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat on him had a bow, and a crown was given unto him, and he went forth conquering and to conquer. Some people think that the white horse is Jesus himself. But I think the fact that Jesus himself is the one loosing the seals should clue us in that he is not a member or a participant in what is being unfolded, apart from being the author of it and the orchestrator of it. These horses and their riders are agents that are appointed by the Lord to accomplish his judgment upon the earth. And again, we can, we'll touch briefly, periodically, on, you know, what these horses might represent and how they might be interpreted. Back to 6, 1 and 2. When the Lamb opens the seal, there is a sound like thunder. I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, come and see. Right? So there is this loud volume. The voice of one of the living creatures. Come and see. And so John responds to that invitation, and he does. And I saw. And then he tells us to look. Right? That's what's going on there in verse number 2. And I saw and look. That's what behold really means. Right? I saw and look. This is what I saw. I'm telling you what I saw. Now you need to see what I saw. I saw this white horse. And again, I'm going to mention this, but I don't want to spend a lot of time. I just don't think that's the purpose of what we're doing. What is this horse? Is the horse a nation? Is the horse a series of events? And again, there are some people who see the white horse as being Jesus, and the conquest is the advance of the gospel. There is one sitting on him with a bow. Is this an individual? And I think, folks, right, we understand that we are dealing with symbols, right, with things that are representative. We have John seeing something and trying to describe for us with the inspiration of the Spirit what it is that he is witnessing, this graphic representation of God's judgment upon the earth. I think a reasonable conclusion, without stretching the symbolism or going crazy, is that the rider on the white horse represents an individual, that there will be a leader. And the horses certainly seem to have some symbolic meaning to their color, right? They're four different colors, and each of the colors brings up imagery in and of its own right. The rider on this horse has a bow, but there is no mention of arrows, and so we wonder, right? The bow is clearly a military dimension. And we wonder if there's any significance to the absence of arrows. In other words, we look at this and we wonder, does he come with the threat of military action more than military action itself? And we ask that in part because there are no arrows mentioned, and we might presume, right? I mean, you would presume, folks, if you saw a gun, right? Anybody who has any experience with weapons knows the first rule of weapons is what? Treat every weapon as if it's loaded. Treat every weapon as if it's loaded. Right? First rule of gun safety. Treat every gun like it's loaded. So we might just go, you don't need to mention who would have a bow with no arrows. But the other reason that we wonder that is because the military dimension seems to come a little bit later. We begin in the early stages with this rider on a white horse with a bow. But not only does he have a bow, he has a crown. Crown is a governmental dimension. He has a military dimension and a governmental dimension. And the crown that he has is not the diadem, but it's actually the word that gives us our English word Stephanie, the victor's crown. His crown. And you don't want to miss this, folks, that this crown was given to him. We don't want to lose sight for even a fraction of a second in the book of Revelation, folks, that all of these events, for all of their mystery and mystique and their horror, or at times their splendor, are directly orchestrated by God himself. This is, folks, this is his day. This is his day. God is going to have his day. And so I would assume that the one who gave him this crown is the Lord himself. And he goes forth, verse number 2, he goes forth conquering and to conquer. Now this word conquering, this is the same word that is found used for every one of the seven churches where it is translated overcomer, the Nikaio. It is where we get the idea of the Nicolaitans, the dominators there. It is also used in Revelation 13:17 to describe the Antichrist's temporary triumph over God's saints. Revelation 13:17. So he goes forth conquering with the intention to conquer. He is not yet a ruler of the world, but he is on that mission. Grammatically, we would argue that conquering and to conquer indicates that he is on a mission of conquest. He is conquering with the intention to conquer. Which leads us to try and place this man within the larger framework, right? We know from the book of Daniel that there's going to be a covenant and that covenant will be radically altered and broken. We know from 1 Thessalonians 5 that there will be a time when there is a declaration that there is peace and safety. And so we kind of anticipate, since he is on a white horse, since he is conquering but he has no arrows, if at the very beginning of his activity, he does not appear to be a savior-like figure. I am conquering for your good. I am conquering not for my own glory, but to benefit the world in all of its turmoil. And part of the logic behind that, folks, are the events that transpire when we see the second seal. But clearly, there is the expansion and consolidation of centralized power in this figure. He is conquering with the intention to conquer. And we'll talk about this a little bit more when we get to the fifth seal and the sixth seal. But we want to recall that these things are not happening in a vacuum. These things are happening on earth. And all of the world will be endeavoring to interpret these events. Right? How do we account for this guy? Right? Lots of people are trying to interpret not only what's going on in Afghanistan right now, but what's been going on in Afghanistan for the last 20 years. We're trying to interpret all of those events and explain them. And there's going to be that dimension to what is happening in this seal. There are going to be people trying to explain it. Some will defend it. No doubt some will critique it. But this is what we have at the very early stages. And I think, and I would be comfortable with this, that it starts out apparently harmless enough with good intentions. Got a guy in a white horse. He is consolidating his strength, but he is making promises that sound good, but will end up very bad. That brings us to verses 3 and 4, the second seal. And when he had opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, "Come and see." And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another, and there was given unto him a great sword. So once again, it is the Lamb, right? Verse number 3, when he had opened the second seal, who is the he? It is the same he of 6:1, the Lamb. Right? The Lamb is the one that has the book in his hand. And now the little Lamb begins to peel back the seals and open the contents of the book. There is no thunderous this time, but we have the second beast. We had met those in chapters 4 and 5. These living creatures. Not human beings, but living beings. And this one says, "Come and see." And John again does just that. John looked, and there went out another horse that was red. And power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth. So this is one of the reasons, folks, that we would argue that the first horse, in spite of the presence of the bow, and in spite of the mission, which is conquest, is relatively benign in his activity. It isn't until the second seal comes that we have the beginning of the bloodbath. And of course, no accident that this horse is red, the color of blood. Look, if you would, again at verse number 4. Power was given unto him. You notice that's italicized. It was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, so that, right? How will peace be removed from the earth? By men killing each other. That's what John is arguing there. That peace will be removed from the earth because the earth will, in effect, go to war against itself. What has happened with the first horse that precipitates this? We can try and find, you know, we can try and correlate in Daniel and the Olivet Discourse. But there's no clear connection in the book of Revelation to what, if anything, the rider on the white horse does to precipitate the events of the red horse. And so he has this great sword because his mission, right? Mission number one, given to him by someone else, is conquest. Mission given to the rider of the red horse, bloodshed. These are their assignments. There is no governmental aspect. There is no economic aspect. There is just pure bloodshed. The inhabitants of earth have turned on each other. And that brings us to the third seal in verses 5 and 6. And when he had opened the third seal, I heard the third beast say, "Come and see." And I beheld, and lo, a black horse. And he that sat on him had a pair of balances in his hand. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say, "A measure of wheat for a penny, three measures of barley for a penny, and see thou hurt not the oil and the wine." So once again, folks, we want to make sure that we note in verse number 5 that the he is the Lamb. The Lamb now unlooses, and again, there is just no end to the discussion on the physical composition of this book and the way the seals are arranged. And we're, you know, it's just not worth talking about. What's the difference? Right? The Lord is peeling back the judgments. Isn't that adequate? The Lord is peeling back the seals, and as the scroll unrolls, or as the pages turn, if you really want it to be that way, they're just one judgment following another. One catastrophe on the heels of another. All being orchestrated by the one who sits on the throne and the one who sits at his right hand. There's a sense in which these events are outside of the control of human beings. Although, I don't think they know that yet. I don't think they understand that yet. So back to verses 5 and 6. We have the third seal in the message of the third beast. Look, and it is a black horse. I looked, and now I see a black horse. This rider has no weapons. He has neither sword nor bow. He has no crown. He has balances. The word balance comes in the New Testament. Much of the time, that word is actually translated with the word yoke. And if you think about the yoke, it's going to look very much like a pair of balances, or a pair of balances is going to look very much like a yoke. The idea is two prongs or twins, one on each side. So we've had some kind of governmental / quasi-military conquest that has led into wholesale bloodshed by the inhabitants of the earth. And now we apparently see the economic impact of the first two seals. And from the middle of the four beasts comes this proclamation. And since, if we went back into chapter 4 and chapter 5, we would discover that the one sitting in the middle of the throne, right, in the middle of the four beasts is the throne and one sitting on the throne, I think they were safe to assume that the voice that is doing the talking, verse number 6, I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts say that this is God himself. That this is God himself. So for those of us who are economy-minded, God himself is determining commodity prices. God himself is the driving market force. Right? If you've done any kind of, and our contractor brother could tell you with tears what it's done to the home building industry, but when we bought, just about 1 year ago, when we bought our flip house, I was buying 2x4s for about $3. At their peak here, not too terribly long ago, that same 2x4 was costing you $13. And prices for those kinds of goods had just skyrocketed. And there were all kinds of shortages, right? And if you said, what's going on? We all had the same answer, COVID. COVID. Right, this is COVID related. All right, so we have insider information here, folks. At this point in the day of the Lord, commodity prices are being determined by heaven. And the commodity prices are as follows. A measure of wheat for a penny and 3 measures of barley for a penny. Let's just stop there. All right, you know this, right? This is pretty familiar to us. A penny was considered to be a standard day's wage, right? And a measure was considered to be about a daily portion. So, right? So they had a point of reference, like we have a point of reference, right? I say to you, you know, a year ago a 2x4 was $3, 5 months ago a 2x4 was $13, And you can relate to that for two reasons. Number one, you know what a 2x4 is. And number two, you understand the purchasing power of a dollar, right? We kind of understand that. So now we kind of got to go backwards and get into their world, right? What we're talking about is about how much money it would take to buy about a day's worth of food. And the answer is that it would take you about a full day's wage to buy a meal. So that, right, let's just say, right, if the average wage, and it's not terribly far off, if the average wage in America is $50,000, $1,000 a week, $200 a day, right, then your groceries for today are going to cost you about $200. So you're going to spend virtually all of your income just feeding yourself. This is not a good economic picture. In fact, folks, if you really want to go off on a tangent and you really read this kind of thing, you will learn very quickly that in all the conversations we have about our diets and obesity in America, one of the things that we never really talk much about is the fact that in America, we spend about the least percentage of our income on food of about anybody that's ever lived in the history of the world. Not only is food abundant in America, it is relatively inexpensive. So we have it in abundance. But at this point in time, it is going to be a starvation kind of world. If you can afford to eat, you can afford to do little else. That much is relatively clear, right? We relate the basic weight price of a commodity, daily's food, to the basic wage of the average wage earner, and they are one and the same. There is a lot more disagreement on the last part of verse number 6. See thou hurt not the oil and the wine. Generally speaking, we would, and I would be comfortable with this, understand it as meaning some luxury goods are virtually unfazed by world events. Right? The events of the first two seals have driven the country, the world in some way, to the brink economically. Which, by the way, folks, as you can imagine, is only going to fuel the events of the second horse. Right? He has a great sword. His mission is to bring bloodshed by causing the inhabitants of the earth to kill each other. And one of the great ways to turn people on each other is to have two people and enough food for one of them. So all of this, in some way, is going to play together, right? I mean, we're watching events unfold, and one thing is going to lead to another. One of the reasons that I would be comfortable in viewing things like oil and wine, right? And again, we have to be very careful here because we can call them luxury items, but I'm not entirely sure that they are luxury items. Right? In 21st century United States, even the religious discussion about alcohol aside, right? I mean, not even going down that road of can I or can I not partake biblically. The bottom line is you have thousands, well, maybe not thousands, hundreds of options of safe beverages that you can consume. That was not true in John's world. You could get water, which may or may not be safe, and you could get milk, but it had to be very fresh because there was really no way to refrigerate it. Or you could have some wine mixture. And again, without getting into all this, I mean, you can just read it. You can find 50,000 Roman historians who have nothing to do with Christianity pointing out to you the ratios that the Romans used to dilute wine with water. They did it all the time. right? It was one way of making the water supply safe. Put fermented beverages in it. All of that to say, the long circuitous route to say, I'm not entirely sure that wine is being presented here as a luxury or that oil is being presented as a luxury. But it is clear that heaven has decreed that some commodities are not impacted. Oil and wine are not going to be on the receiving end of the kind of crunch that wheat and barley are. And they are certainly much less necessary. You can live without wine. You can live without oil. It's pretty hard to live without food. So those things that are essential take on a greater preciousness during this period of time. So again, folks, I'm not uncomfortable with it referring to luxurious or, you know, even, you know, upper middle class kind of things, because that's part of the ongoing conflict, and I think that I can defend it a little bit when we get down into the sixth seal, but we'll worry about that a later time. That brings us to verses 7 and 8, the fourth seal. When it opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth beast say, come and see, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him, and power was given unto them over the fourth part of the earth, to kill with sword and with hunger and with death and with the beasts of the earth. So once again, it is the Lamb peeling back the seal or loosening the seal. It is the fourth of the living creatures now calling John's attention to look. And when he looks, he sees a pale horse. And the idea with pale there is kind of a yellowish green Halloween-y looking horse. Is that a word, Halloween-y? You know, the color that you would see a witch or a zombie colored for Halloween, a deathly green. And his rider is death, and hell follows. And hell there indicates the grave, right? Death followed by the grave. That's, I mean, certainly hell in the larger eternal sense, but I think the immediate imagery is death and the grave. And his authority, right, this again is given to him. Power was given unto them. Right? There are two riders. Power is given unto them, death and hell. And they bring widespread human destruction to the planet. One-fourth part of the earth. One-fourth part of the earth. And they have the power to do this with the sword, which we would assume just violent death and killing. This will come through hunger, which takes us back to the third seal. Death, and we would understand death there to be a reference to disease and pestilence, which again, you know, if it all began to happen today, folks, right? If it all began to happen today, right? We live in this precious little bubble in the Western world of sanitation and modern medicine, but much of the world still doesn't have easy access to those things. So that when people begin to die in mass, it will take a while for them to be addressed. And all of the things that come from dead and decomposing bodies will be out there for people to contract. Pestilence, we think, is the idea. And then there will be also just the animals of the earth. And we want to remember, folks, that this is God's judgment and these are his critters. And the God who can tell the lions to not eat Daniel can tell the lions to eat whoever they wishes. And here's the boundary that is set. 25% of the earth's population. If it happened today, that would mean just shy of 2 billion people. About 1.95 billion people is 25% of the Earth's population. Or in other words, all of Europe, all of North America, all of South America. Gone. And the time span for this, folks, I mean, if you're just as generous as you can possibly be with this, the time span for that is 7 years. But I would argue this is all going to happen in nothing near 7 years. Just barely approaching 3.5 years. We're talking something on the verge of a billion people a year dying at this time. That's almost unbelievable. Jesus, talking about these events in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, called them the beginning of sorrows. So when we get to the fourth seal, right, there are 21 judgments unfolded in vials, trumpets, and seals. When we get to the fourth seal, we've got one quarter of the earth dead. We've got famine. We've got war. We've got unprecedented catastrophe. Only the beginning. All right, I'm going to stop there tonight. Again, next Wednesday night, Lord willing, we will take up the fifth seal. If you want